All right. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you all, and I'm trying to think. My association here with Avalon Hills Bible Church goes back to the days of Steve Thibault, and so that's a long time ago. Some of you maybe don't even know that name, but anyway, I'm thankful for the opportunity to be here. We appreciate your ministry and having. I'm a member of Colonial Baptist Church, been there for some 20 years, and associated with the seminary that is there. So it's always good to be with sister churches, those who share the same faith, like faith and practice. I just count it a great joy. This morning, as I've contemplated what to share with you on Mother's Day, this is a very special day. I haven't talked to my mom yet today. She's 87, soon to be 87. My dad went home to be in heaven a couple of years ago, so she's adjusting to some of these things. And of course, my wife is a mother. She and I, God has given us five sons, and so they're grown and walking with the Lord, and four of them live in this area. One is up in New York, soon to move down here, so we're going to have them all here pretty soon. And among those, now we have 10 grandchildren, with the 11th one on the way, due in August, I believe it is. So we're blessed. You know, the Lord has just showered us with blessings. So this is a very special day. We want to honor the mothers on this day, mothers and grandmothers. So I've chosen a text that, and I'm going to ask you to turn there, 2 Samuel chapter 21. Now, I'd be surprised if your Bibles fall open to that passage from heavy use. I would be surprised if very many of you at all have ever even heard a sermon on 2 Samuel 21. Perhaps some. I would be even more surprised if anyone has ever heard a sermon on 2 Samuel 21 on Mother's Day of all days. But you'll hear one today. And it's special to me. You'll see in a moment. But it's a powerful, powerful passage. We're only going to look at the first 14 verses. I'm going to read from the ESV, and just follow with me if you can. Verse 1, now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the face of the Lord. And the Lord said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he has put the Gibeonites to death. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. Although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. And David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you, and how shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of the Lord? The Gibeonites said to him, it is not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house, neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. And he said, what do you say that I shall do for you? They said to the king, the man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel, let 7 of his sons be given to us, so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. The king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth. And the five sons of Merav, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite, and he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the mountain before the Lord, and the seven of them perished together. They were put to death in the first days of harvest at the beginning of the barley harvest. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until rain fell upon them from the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had stolen them from the public square at Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines killed Saul on Gilboa. And he brought up from there the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who were hanged, and they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish his father. And they did all that the king commanded. And after that, God responded to the plea for the land. Doesn't sound like much of a Mother's Day passage, does it? I bet you can't wait. Well, I have to set up the context for you if we're going to get the meaning and be able to make the proper application. There are basically three things that make up the framework of this story as I see it. The first one has to do with, well, first of all, let me give you the exegetical premise. The exegetical premise of this passage that we just read, these 14 verses, is that God keeps his promises. And he honors those who keep theirs. So God keeps his promises. Covenant is another way of saying promises, only it's a little bit more formalized than a mere promise. It's actually legal and its parties are involved. But God keeps his covenants. God keeps his promises and he honors those who keep theirs. And we have all kinds of covenant relationships represented here in this auditorium this morning. If you're married, you're in a covenantal relationship. If you're a Christian, you're in a covenantal relationship. If you're a member of this church, you're in a covenantal relationship. If you're a son or a daughter in a home with parents, you're in a covenantal relationship. So this passage applies to us very clearly on the broad principles. God is a God who keeps his covenants. He takes them seriously, and he wants you to take your covenants seriously. And so this passage is going to teach us much about that. And so for our moms here, the moms that are here, they're in a covenantal relationship. And the way they perform that relationship is a relationship that's worthy of honor, as we shall soon see. Okay, so that's the exegetical premise. Now, the framework of the story, there are three things to keep in mind that this passage is all about. I hope you picked up on some of these as we go through it. The first one is that it's bookended by a request for prayer and then an answer to prayer, right? So it begins by David seeking the face of the Lord and asking God for his help. And then all of this that we read, and we come down to the last verse, and God answers his prayer because of all that took place in the passage. So it's about prayer. It's in the context of a prayer and the way God answers that prayer. The second thing is that laced throughout this passage, and virtually every verse, is the idea of covenants, various covenants. Ones that have been kept and ones that have been broken. It's all throughout here. And the third thing that we see, and I'm going to suggest is the heart of this, is the idea of substitutionary atonement. Where someone is taken, their life is given on behalf of someone else. All right, so with those in mind, we want to work our way through the storyline and see how it goes, and we'll bring out some of these points and applications as we go. So you see there in the first verse that there was famine in the days of David for 3 years. I should say one thing about the placement of this passage in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. These two books originally were one book in one megaloth scroll, and So it's one story. And basically, these last chapters, 21 through 24, are, the scholars tell us, are basically appendices to the storyline. So 1 Samuel is largely about Saul and his reign, and up through, I think, about chapter 6 of 2 Samuel. And then from there, it's David. And when we get to the end of chapter 20, that's pretty much how the chronological storyline goes, and it ends. And then these last chapters here have kind of like an inverted order. They're appendages put on to the end. And so they're not necessarily, we got to fit them where they go in the storyline in 1 Samuel. I won't spend much time there because it would take too much time to do it. I just want you to know that. And you can trace that out on your own. So the famine has happened, and notice how it says for 3 years, year after year. So the idea is that it's three consecutive years and that it's really getting severe. And you got to keep in mind, again, this is another subtle reference to God's covenant with Israel. God had promised them way back in the days of Joshua. Right after Moses dies, the book of Joshua opens up and God says, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you be very strong, be very courageous, and you go and you take this land that I've given you, and every place that you step your foot is yours. The people's heart will melt, but you do have to take it. It's not going to be yours if you don't go in and take it. So you have to take it, but they're not going to stand a chance. They will just be so afraid. It will be an easy victory. And so as they go in and they take this, there is also the promise that Moses had given them, the covenant called the Palestinian covenant, Deuteronomy 29 and 30, where God says, look, I'm giving you this land and you can stay in the land as long as you obey me. As long as you keep my promises, as long as you do the things I tell you to do, you can stay in this land. Whenever you start going after other gods and doing other things, I will raise up other nations and they will come in and they will disperse you across the four corners of the earth. So we're here and David is now, you know, we had Saul as a king and now David is risen up as a king. This is some 30 years after Saul died. We think it could be a little sooner, some of the chronology there. It could be actually just a few years after David ascended the throne. So a little bit we can't be 100% sure on. But the point is that Saul did his rule and then he's dead. And David now is now held account for something that Saul did, which we will soon see. So notice what says. So David, now he goes to God in prayer because God promised that in this land, my covenant is not just with you, it's with the land. So as long as you and the people of Israel seek me and serve me and worship me and don't go after other gods, this land will bear fruit for you. I will send the rains. You got to understand the topography of Palestine, of that land of Israel. It was utterly dependent upon rainfall. They didn't have irrigation channels and all these kinds of things. God designed the topography from the mountain ranges and all of that, that there had to be rain for the land to be productive. And who can give rain? Well, only God. So God then can withhold the rain if the people are not seeking God. And he does this. David, a man after God's own heart, this is probably before his time with Bathsheba and some of the other sins that he committed. So he is a man after God's own heart. Why isn't God blessing? So he seeks the face of the Lord. And so the Lord answers him. At the end of verse 1 there, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. All right, so the first principle we would learn about covenants and how to honor those we are in covenant with is that covenants always, 100% of the time, always involve God. And so it's foolish to think that we can keep our covenants without involving God, that is, without prayer. You see, covenants are those things, they're always under assault, they're always being assailed by the enemy. Because if he can get us to violate our covenants, to break our words, to disregard the permanence of a promise, then he has undermined and maligned the name of God himself, especially among those who claim to have the name of God. So covenants are always under assault. It's a foundation to our relationship. And just like any foundation, foundations always have to be checked, always have to be secured, always have to be monitored to make sure it's not being eroded by other principles, by other things that are assailing it. And it's the same thing is true in our relationships. So we're foolish if we think we can keep our covenants without invoking God, without praying and asking God and seeking the face of God. So that's the first simple principle I would draw. But notice what happens then. So the king called the Gibeonites and he spoke to them, and they were, now got to know our history, our Bible history. This takes us back now from this point 300 years prior to when Joshua is in the land. You remember what God said to them back in Joshua chapter 9? He said, when you go into the land, you are not to make a pact, a league, a contract, a covenant with anybody in the land. Why? Because their whole mission was to rout the land. Their whole mission was to conquer the land. So you can't make a pact with them and conquer them at the same time. So he says, don't do that. Well, Joshua, in his haste, I mean, they conquered place after place after place. But then they come to this group of travelers that look like they came from a long distance away. Tattered clothes, moldy bread. And we read that story in Joshua chapter 9 where they had heard of all of the conquest of the Israelites and they were afraid. So they concocted the scheme. We're going to put on these old clothes. We're going to get moldy bread and we're going to tell them we came from a long way away and that we're not part of this territory. And Joshua didn't do his due diligence to find out whether they're telling the truth or not. And so in compassion, though naively, they entered into a contract, a covenant with the Gibeonites right there in Joshua chapter 9. Now, it was under false pretenses, but here's the thing. God still held them accountable, even though it was under false pretenses. The covenant was still viewed by God as absolutely valid. This happens all the time in our relationships, right? We have clear revelation in the New Testament that a believer is not to marry an unbeliever. And it may very well be that the unbeliever professes salvation so that he can marry this believer, and then they end up in an unequal yoke. But that's still a valid covenant that has to be maintained. So, what happens next? So, the Gibeonites then, we're told in these early verses, that Saul, some 300 years later, when a lot of this had been forgotten about, I mean, think back 300 years ago from our country. It's before it was even founded, right? And imagine a covenant still being held intact. So 300 years back, but Saul comes along in his campaign, in his zeal for Israel and Judah. He sets on a mission to exterminate. It's like a Holocaust. But he set on a mission to exterminate the Gibeonites. They were not Israelites, but they were in contract, in covenant with the Israelites, and he sought to wipe them out. And so this is about 30 years, possibly 20 to 30 years, or could be 10 years, who knows, could be 5 years ago, but it's some time has lapsed between that campaign and what we read here. And so now picture who all is the fallout of this. You've got widows. You've got orphans. No doubt if he's seeking to exterminate an entire people, he's killing not just men of war, but he's wiping out houses and moms and children and grandchildren. This is an awful, horrific thing that Saul, the king of Israel, did to a people who was supposed to be protecting the Gibeonites. So the famine comes on the land because God has to have this dealt with. His name is on the line. So what happens? So they come to David, a representative group come to him. These now, maybe 10, 15, 20 years later, these orphans who at one time asking their mom, when's dad coming home? Sorry, son, he won't be back. Mom, why does everybody hate us so much? I don't know, son. I don't have the answer for that. And now these men, perhaps grown by now, they come and they stand before David, just a remnant of people. And David says, what would you suggest that I do? And they said, well, you know, we don't have, if you look at it in verse, let me find it here. Verse 4, the Gibeonite said to him, it's not a matter of silver or gold. In other words, there's not enough money, not enough silver or gold that you could give me that would make up for what has happened. And secondly, it's not in our legal rights to take action to bring any kind of vengeance back. We can't legally do that. Only you, David, can act on our behalf, is how I take what they're saying to him. And so David says to them, well, what would you suggest that I do? And then they say, we want seven men from the sons of Saul. Now, why seven? Well, so there's a word play that goes on that we don't catch it in the English. It's only in the original. So the word for swearing an oath and the word for seven come from the same Hebrew word. In fact, our word seven, S-E-V-E-N, and our word Sabbath all come from the same word. Sava. If you remember back in Genesis when there was a battle for wells between Isaac and I believe it was the Philistines or whoever it was, they're fighting for these wells, and finally they make a compact and say, okay, this you can have this well, and then seven ewe lambs are sacrificed there, and so the seven lambs are sacrificed, and they swear an oath. You remember what the name of that place was called? It was over wells, and the name for well in Hebrew is B-E-E-R, pronounced Be'er, Be'er Sheva, the well of seven, the well of seven oaths, and the well of seven ewe lambs, if you will. The point is, this was an ironclad covenant about whose property this was. And so you have this kind of thing happening here, this play between the swearing an oath and the number seven. So I want seven sons of Saul, probably a symbolic number designed to represent completion and fullness. So David says, okay, I'll do that. Now, what they do then is they take these seven sons. So David has the unenviable task of choosing now seven sons. And some people say that David really had a heart of evil. It's a way for him to get back at Saul and to have a vengeful spirit. I don't see that in the text at all. But he does choose seven sons. Now, we don't know. You remember in another place where David makes a covenant with Mephibosheth, one of Jonathan's sons, right? So he's got to be careful in the sons that he chooses that he himself doesn't violate his own covenant. And now we read about another Mephibosheth, and so if you're not careful, it's almost as though it contradicts itself. But we're probably to take that second Mephibosheth as a grandson and not the one that David made the covenant with. So I know it gets complicated, but if you can follow that or maybe think about it later, The point is, David is keeping his covenant with God and with the Gibeonites, making it right, and yet with Mephibosheth, and he chooses seven men to do that. So he says, I will give them. And so now we see, we'll come down here to verse 10, where it says, then Rizpah. Now, what's this story have to do with Rizpah? Well, she is an interesting woman. Why is it even there? We could take verses 10 and 11 out of the passage, and it moves seamlessly. And we just go right into it's a flowing narrative, but we have two verses on this woman, this mother. Why? Why is it there? And I want to suggest to you that it's a part of it. She represents what it means to honor covenants. We honor covenants with courage. Covenants are always under attack. They're always being assailed. So we have to be brave enough to defend them. Covenants are always being, must always be defended, and since they're going to be assailed, we need to expect that we will suffer in the defending of our covenants. I mean, if you've been married for any time at all, you know that's true. You made a covenant with your spouse that in sickness and in health, rich or poor, good or bad as it gets, only death will separate you. Well, I'm here to tell you that when they show up in the counseling room, they're willing to separate over a lot more than that. And so their covenants are right there at, and someone is asked now, are you willing to suffer for your covenant? There is no possible way we can keep our covenants if we're not willing to suffer. So we have to learn to suffer redemptively in our covenants if they're ever to be maintained. Isn't that exactly what God did for us? He made a covenant with us, and the only way for that covenant to be maintained, for Him to be faithful to His promises, is for Him to suffer on our behalf through a substitutionary sacrifice, through Jesus Christ, when He went to Calvary and became the sin bearer for our sins. And if He would do that for us, can we not expect the same that we must do for our own covenants that we have? We are told in Philippians that we're actually called to suffer. And it's Mother's Day, so let's make the obvious application. Every mom suffers. I mean, to have childbirth is an act of suffering. We read that in Genesis 3, that God said, I'm going to multiply your pain in childbirth. Both the frequency of the cycle of ovulation as well as the pain in childbirth itself. In my particular interpretation of Genesis 3, where it says, her desire will be to you and you shall rule over her, I don't take that as a negative. I don't take that to mean that that's the battle of the sexes. I know that's a popular view. I take that to simply mean, in spite of all of the pain and the suffering that God promises in childbirth, women are still going to want to get married. They're still going to want to have babies, despite the suffering that's going to be involved in it. And, you know, we're spoiled in this day and age. For centuries, when women would give birth to children, they did not know if they would even survive the event. Right? Many women have died giving birth. We even read about it with Rachel, Jacob's beloved wife. When she gave birth to Benjamin, she died in childbirth. It's only the modern conventions that have saved many, many lives of women giving birth to children. So what we have here is a picture of a woman. I call it a mother's vigil. And what's she doing? Her sons are dead. Their corpses are impaled on a pole. And the text tells us that she spreads out her sackcloth, and the wording there is that she pinned it. The idea is that she set up a little bit of a tent, and she's going to camp out there. Do you see how long she's going to do this? I mean, she's committed to this from the early rains until the rain falls. Scholars tell us that that could be anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months. Even 3 weeks. You ever go camping for 3 weeks? Man, 1 week. I'm pretty much, I'm ready now to go back home, getting clean sheets, quit fighting the insects. I've got all these bug bites. So for 3 weeks at least, she's going to be there. And what's she going to do? She's going to fight off the buzzards, chase away the jackals, so that they don't get the corpses of her sons. Why? Because she believes in a God who keeps His promises. She is a mom who is going to defend her sons and make sure that her sons died for a purpose and for a reason. And she's not going to be afraid. She's the kind of mom that says, I don't care, I will put myself in harm's way. When I was a kid, just a little scrawny kid, maybe in kindergarten or first grade, we lived, there was an empty lot, couple of empty lots, just two houses down from us. I'm the youngest of four, and my brother was 3 years older than me. And we would go out to this empty lot, and we would play. We'd play baseball. And so we were playing, and these two older kids came along. They're about my brother's age, and they asked if they could play. I said, sure, why not? So for whatever reason, I ended up sitting and watching and not playing, and didn't much like that. And so they're playing, and I just decided I'd be part of the game. So I'm, giving all this chit-chat to these two guys, hey, batter swing, and all this stuff, and kind of annoying them. I'm the youngest person around. And so, they're batting, and my brother and sisters are out in the field. And they said, hey, kid, shut up. So they threw another pitch. Hey, batter swing. Hey, kid, I said, shut up. Well, I wasn't real bright at that time, and so I kept it up, annoying the life out of them. And finally they said, you better tell your kid brother to shut up, or he's going to get it. Of course, I said it again. And then the next thing I know, they're on top of me, and then my brother runs, and he jumps on them, and then they're on top of him, and I'm watching. My sisters are screaming, and one sister runs home to get my mom, the other sister just shouting and screaming, and this fisticuffs going on, and my mom comes out with a frying pan. You get away from my boys! You get away from them! And they took off running. I mean, they were so scared. It wouldn't have mattered if it were two bears. My mom would have come out and just, you're not getting my boys, no way. So, I read this story. I think of that. I think of my mom. She is the quintessential mom. She'll lay down her life for her kids. This lady, Rizpah, I think the same. Quintessential mom. Her sons are already dead, but she knows that what is it for? It has to be for some reason, for some dignity, for some something. And so she perseveres. She stays right there. There's no way. Until I see the rain fall on my son's body, I'm not stopping. I'm chasing away the jackals. I'm chasing away the buzzards. Because my sons, their life will have meaning to a nation. And not just sentimental reasons for me. So, beasts of the field. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, he went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan. So this moved David. He was just beside himself that a mom would do. Where were all the other? Where was the mother of the five sons that died? Where was that mom? Rizpah was there, and she's a concubine, you know, second class. She's there. Where's the daughter of Saul who gave birth to these five sons? Rizpah says, no way. I'm not going away until I know it has meaning. In 1989, my brother Barry, that I just mentioned, died of cancer. He was 37. Three kids, ages 5 to 9. And when he suffered for 2 years through chemotherapy, bone marrow transplant, you name it. It was a terrible ordeal. But my mom told me in the last moments of his death, she and my dad sat beside him there, and he's hooked up to all this paraphernalia, the breathing aspirator, all of the accoutrements there in the room and the beeps and all of these things happening. And she's putting her hand through his hair, whispering to him, talking to him. And then the aspirator quit. She kept loving on him. About 30 minutes later, the heart monitor flatlined. She watched her son die. Nurse came in and said, let me clean him up for you so you can have some time with him. And she did. And she spent the last few moments there saying goodbye to her son. My dad was with her. And I think of, again, this story of a mom over the corpse of her sons and says, this will have meaning only in the light of God's redemptive purposes, God's redemptive suffering. And while that event was very, very tough on my mom, on our whole family, my mom has been able to have a tremendous ministry, ministering to others who have gone through similar things, and I'm really, really proud of her for that. Even though I call her every day on the anniversary of his death, I mean every year on the anniversary of his death, and we talk, and she misses him like it was yesterday. So when we look at this passage, I have to ask, I have to bring it to a close and ask you the question, what are you doing with your covenants? The covenants, they don't keep themselves. We keep our covenants. God is faithful to his covenants, and he keeps them. And it takes courage to keep our covenants. It takes a willingness to suffer to keep our covenants. And it takes a willingness to persevere to keep our covenants until we see God make good on it. Until the rains fall. And that's exactly what happened. It's not until David does his part and he takes the bones and he buries the bones, and only then, after the mother's vigil with Rizpah, after David follows through and he prays and God answers prayer and the covenant is preserved, God's name is glorified, and there is a people now standing in a right relationship with God. You see, our covenants are designed so that we can glorify God in them, and part of that glory may be that God calls you to suffer in your covenants so that we can be like Christ, so that we can show Christ to the world. And that's the only place we find ultimate fulfillment and satisfaction. Any other way is a side door exit leading to a dank and barren alley. We want to go through the trial as James 1 tells us. And that trial will often involve suffering because he's refining us, he's refining our faith, and in doing that, we're better reflectors of his glory to a world that desperately, desperately is looking for something to hang on to. And the only thing worth hanging on to is a reliable covenant that points back to God. So my challenge to us today is, mothers, thank you for that. You model for us. My guess is many homes, most homes, even though it's not perfect, but there are mothers there who demonstrate what it means to have a covenant that they're courageous to protect, that they are willing to suffer for, and that they persevere when it costs them much. Will you bow your heads and pray with me, please? Father, thank you for your holy word. Thank you for the hope that you give to us. And we thank you for the moms who demonstrate so faithfully the heart of Christ, your heart, that you would seek us, desperate sinners. So thank you for the salvation we have in Jesus Christ, that we can look to another hill and another son and another mother who watched her son die, and that son is our Savior. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.